This is WJBC This Week.
I put my head down and just focused on what was important in this race.
I thought I did as best I could.
It's not a needs or wants conversation anymore. It's a how are you going to do it.
All of those are very important, and important that we address sooner rather than later.
Evidence exists in the fact that Ron and negotiators have negotiated a reasonable, acceptable Teamsters contract.
Illinois State is known for being somewhat selective. We bring in highly motivated, high-achieving, civically engaged students.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, we'll hear from Darren LaHood following his election to Congress in a special election to replace Aaron Schock. Norwell approves a sales tax increase that hinges on Bloomington doing the same. We'll hear from a town councilman who backed the tax hike. An investigative reporter shares insights into what's likely the biggest nonprofit business in the country, college football. Plus, we have two WJBC Throwback Thursday interviews with a former WJBC newsman, Mark Dennis, and former Redbird football coach, Denver Johnson. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. The only vacant U.S. House seat was filled this week when State Senator Darren LaHood of Peoria won a special election over Rob Mellon, a high school teacher from Quincy, to take over the 18th Congressional District seat that Aaron Schock had held and was once held by Darren's father, Ray LaHood. He served there for seven terms. The younger LaHood talked with WJBC's Joe Ragusa after the victory.
Now that the election is official, how do you feel that you won?
Well, it's very gratifying and humbling to have the voters do what they did today in this election. And it's a humbling experience. And I'm honored to be the congressman-elect and look forward to trying to do the best job I can to represent this district.
And in talking with your opponent, Rob Mellon, he admitted that he was the underdog in this race. And I guess the question to you would be the opposite of that. Did you feel during this race like you had the advantage, or you were the favorite in the race?
You know what? I put my head down and just focused on what was important in this race. We worked very hard over the last 6 months. We took nothing for granted, and we earned every vote. And whether that was our grassroots effort, whether that was talking about the issues that were important. We did, I think, 45 parades over the course of the summer. We went to all 19 county fairs. We visited every farm bureau. So, we worked hard on the ground level, and I think that paid off tonight.
How do you feel about the voter turnout? It looks like about 8% or 9%, at least in McLean County, and I imagine throughout most of the district as well. And I don't really know if it really swayed things one way or the other for you in this election, but how do you feel overall about the actual turnout of the election?
Well, I think it's a reflection of having a special election. This was the only thing on the ballot. It was in the middle of the summer. We had the first primary in July and the second one on a Thursday in September, and it's hard to get people motivated to get out and vote. It's not an election that people gravitate towards like a presidential election. And so we had to work extra hard to get our message out there, which we did.
And now that you are the congressman-elect, whenever you're sworn in, I imagine that's going to be pretty soon, pretty immediately. You're going to be basically thrown right into the fire. I mean, you've got things like the Iran deal that's still being discussed. I know the Senate voted on that on Thursday to block the disapproval of that plan. And you have a bunch of other issues that you're going to be thrown into as well, and even the heated atmosphere with all the presidential politics going on for the 2016 election. So what are the first few things that you are going to do in office now that you are the congressman?
Well, listen, on every issue, I'm going to take it seriously. I want to read every bill that comes before for a vote, and I want to try to be the most constructive member of Congress that I can be. And I got a lot to learn, there's no doubt. A lot to learn on issues, on process, procedure. But I look forward to surrounding myself with bright, smart people at the staff level and also mentors in the Illinois Congressional Delegation and elsewhere to try to be the best advocate and represent this district the best I can. And I think in terms of the issues that are important, I've talked extensively about fiscal responsibility. I've talked about smaller government, term limits, ethics and transparency. And lastly, how do we get the economy booming again in the country? And so those are issues I talked about over the last 6 months, and I'll continue to advocate for those at the federal level.
And we already pretty much assume that you're going to run in 2016. I mean, if you're the sitting congressman, that's pretty much a no-brainer, right?
Well, obviously, we're going to enjoy the victory tonight, and we'll get started tomorrow on petitions for next year. That when we looked at this originally, we looked at the potential for four elections in 16 months, and that's unfortunately the way this works in terms of the special election.
Do you feel like you'll be prepared to do a campaign in 2016? I know a lot of the attention's been focused on this, but the quick turnaround, like we've talked about, is going to be an issue for yourself and also for pretty much any candidate. I know there's only the one candidate that's announced, the independent, David Gill. Do you feel like that quick turnaround is going to impact your campaign one way or the other?
Well, listen, we got a great team in place. We obviously were effective in this election. We were effective in the July election. We're going to keep that team in place, and we're going to go strong through the fall here and into next year. And I'm going to continue to advocate for the issues that I feel so strongly about.
Now, before I let you go, I do want to get your take on this, because when I was speaking with Mellon, he also had an interesting take on the percentages. And that came out as far as the number of voters and how many he got. And he got around 31% or so. But he pointed out the fact that in the primary, all of the voters for the Democratic Party compared to the Republican Party, the Democrats only made up about 13%. And he received about 30%. Do you take any stock in that at all?
You know, I haven't looked at those numbers, so I mean, I'd have to look at those first. I'm happy with the plurality we received tonight. I think 69-70% is very, very strong, and we're happy with that.
All right, Mr. LaHood, anything else? Any other thoughts that now that you are going to be the congressman in the 18th Congressional District?
Nope, I would just say, you get a real sense of responsibility in this job. And again, I look forward to moving forward and to best represent this district and put a good team in place and be a strong vocal advocate for this district and the values that people have in this district.
That was State Senator and Congressman-elect Darren LaHood with Joe Ragusa. Normal's Town Council voted this week to increase its sales tax rate by 1%, while Bloomington is in the midst of considering the same as one of many options to trim a multimillion-dollar deficit. WJBC's Scott Laughlin talked with Normal Town Councilman R.C. McBride this week, one day before the town endorsed the tax hike, on the condition that Bloomington do the same.
Would one do it without the other, or is this something that you both have to kind of...
You're referring to the proposed sales tax,
right?
1%, and that, and we are going to be discussing that at tomorrow night's meeting. Now, traditionally, the two communities have kept the sales tax rate the same between the two. So, while I suppose there's nothing precluding one or the other from making a move, I think there are very good reasons traditionally for us keeping the sales tax rate the same. So, I would expect that to continue in the future.
All right. So let me ask you this, because I thought of it a couple of weeks ago. I think we were talking to somebody from Bloomington, and then somebody asked me, so I'll ask you.
Okay.
Isn't that collusion?
Collusion?
Isn't that collusion? You guys working together to set a tax rate. One wouldn't be without the other.
I'm not sure that term would necessarily apply. I mean, first of all, we're very open about it, and collusion, by definition,
right,
I think kind of implies that you're working, behind closed doors or behind the scenes. I mean, I always think, and you and I are old enough to remember this, what was it, 25 years ago when all baseball owners colluded not to sign any free agents.
Right.
But nobody was saying anything about that publicly. So, no, I don't think collusion would apply.
So how's your feeling on that? I mean, if it came to a vote today, how are you going to vote on that?
Well, I mean, at this point, and I've heard from a lot of people, and the one thing that I've heard that actually makes me feel pretty good, and sometimes I think it's gotten lost in the shuffle a little bit, a quarter percent or a quarter of the 1%, depending on how you want to phrase it, is going to go to work with the county and presumably the city would go along with this as well to address our mental health concerns. I mean, recent events have kind of been an indicator, I think, of how we need some work in that area. We need an upgrade in facilities. We need more services available. So I really look at that as the driving force behind this. And therefore, I do think it will likely pass. The way the ordinance is written, and this is probably an important distinction to make, the way the ordinance is written as proposed going into the meeting tomorrow night is it would be a 1% increase with a quarter of that being set aside for mental health to work with the city and the county on that issue. And it's also contingent upon the city of Bloomington doing the same thing. In other words, also raising 1% and addressing a quarter of that to mental health. Now, what would happen to the rest of that is still up for discussion. And I realize that we in the town of Normal have talked about what we feel are some of our priorities, but we also realize that the city of Bloomington, for a variety of reasons, may have different priorities.
Well, you know, the city of Bloomington, they've got that task force, and they're looking at maybe some places they can cut. They're also looking at that possible tax increase. Has the town of Normal done its due diligence on looking at ways to cut spending?
Well, the town of Normal has a balanced budget. So at this point, I don't necessarily think there's any need to cut. Now, those times may come. Everybody's very well aware of what's happening at the state and the trickle-down effect that that has on municipalities, school districts, and everything else. But the town of Normal has a balanced budget. So the things that we have been identifying as priorities, mental health, along with economic development, the idea of going out and trying to drum up more tourism business, the idea of a soccer complex, those are all new things.
That was Normal Town Councilman R.C. McBride with Scott Laughlin. Even though it shrouds itself with the trappings of education and tradition, college football is above all a big business, a $2.5 billion a year entertainment industry. Investigative reporter Gilbert Gall, author of Billion Dollar Ball, discusses the big money world of college football with WJBC's Steve Fast this week.
The 10 largest programs grossed $229 million in 1999, and that's jumped to $762 million in 2002. What are some of the ways that college football programs are making money that they hadn't in the past?
Right. Well, it's not so much how they hadn't in the past. There's some truth to that, but generally what has happened is the scale has exploded in college football. And so things like something, again, average fans probably don't understand, is something called seat donations. So if you want to get one of the better seats at a college football stadium, take Alabama, the waiting list as of 2013 was 26,000 strong to get a season ticket to a football game at Alabama. So the only way you're going to get that ticket is one of two ways. You can either write them a check, a huge check for thousands and thousands of dollars to move up the list, to jump up to the head of the list, to get eligible to get a ticket, or you can make annual payments year after year after year to, let's assume they have either a booster club or some type of organization, which most schools do, to handle the ticketing for college football. And you are required to make these mandatory payments in order to get these premium seats. So that's a phenomena that really kind of grew up starting in the mid-'80s and then explodes in the 90s and 2000s. So that at places like Texas, if you want to try to get a seat on the 50- or 40-yard line, you're talking about, you know, writing a check for $25,000 or thereabouts in order to be just eligible to get that. So on top of that, you have all of the scaling up of the payments from ESPN and Fox and CBS for the television fees and broadcasting rights. You have the corporate money that's come in, the advertising. You have the Nike, Under Armour, all those apparel-type companies and their corporate sponsorship money coming in. And then, you know, finally, you have the ticket prices. So you have those three major or four major sources of income.
We're talking with reporter Gilbert Gall. His new book, Billion Dollar Ball, takes a look at the big money culture of college football. One of the things that is unique about college football in the sports entertainment industry and this scaling that you talk about is the tax picture. For instance, when somebody buys one of these seat donations, when they give this money to reserve their season tickets in these prime locations, the purchaser, do they pay taxes on all of that?
No. So what happened was the IRS in the mid-'80s, in 1984, took a look at these seat donation schemes, and they concluded appropriately that, you know what, this is not charity. This is a quid pro quo. You're getting something in return for your payment. It's a purchase. So they tried to tax it, and long story short, the football lobby beat it back. And in, I think it was 1988, if I remember correctly, that Congress actually embedded in legislation language allowing these, I'll put it in quotations, donors to deduct 80% of the cost of the seat, mandatory seat payment as a charitable gift to the university.
When you look at some of these big TV contracts, money that the athletic departments are bringing in from these negotiations through all the schools for ESPN or somebody to pay for exclusive rights, do the schools pay taxes on that revenue that's coming in?
No, they don't. And those contracts generally are negotiated not by individual schools, but by the conferences. So the Pac-12 back in, don't hold me to this year, 2010, renegotiated its television contracts, put them out for bid. And ESPN and Fox bid jointly. And I think the total payment, long-term payment to the Pac-12 is equal to about $3 billion over X number of years. So all of that money that flows back is considered tax exempt. It's considered part of the charitable mission of the universities. So in other words, in effect, the way I put it is it's the unlikely charity known as college football.
Well, let's talk about this charitable mission. Obviously, these are academic institutions, and they pretty much run on the backs of student athletes, scholar athletes. Let's talk about those athletes. They aren't paid to play. It's a scandal if they were to receive a gift of any kind, but they get free tuition often, and I think it would be naive to say that many of these athletes aren't there to play football and that their education is secondary. So let's talk about their education. How much money do athletic departments spend to keep these kids within the academic rules so they're eligible to play?
Right. So one of the things that has changed, and depending upon your point of view, this is either a good thing or another example of the scaling up of college football and to a certain extent the absurdity of how large and how distorting the effect of football has become on these elite football universities, is they have now what are known as academic support centers. And they literally, what I call them, are charter schools for athletes, especially for football players and basketball players, because those are the two problem sports for the most part. And it involves everything from making sure they get up, students get up to go to class. They have, at University of Kansas, they have 15 retirees who are assigned athletes each morning at 8 o'clock. They go to where the athletes are supposed to show up and then log them in, have them sign in to the classes so they know whether they're showing up or not showing up. At Oregon, I think they do 1,700 hours of tutoring per week at a $42 million extraordinarily lavish building that is exclusive for athletes. That has computer labs. They all get a free Apple laptop. They have tutoring sessions. They have academic advisors. They have reading and writing specialists. They have life coaches. They have psychologists. You name it. So there's incredibly large and expensive infrastructure that's been created in the last two decades to keep these players eligible. And again, depending on your perspective, this is great. This is what the university should be doing. It owes the athletes at least this much. Or you could say, as I guess I argue in my book, that that's true, but it's another example of how college football has basically run amok.
And those are resources, as you mentioned, that are exclusive to athletes. I think you've done a comparison on how much money an organization like Oregon that you talk about is spending per athlete compared to how much they would spend per regular student.
Yeah, well, I do that for many of the large football schools. And, you know, it depends on how you slice and dice the number. The Knight Commission has a database, and they slice it one way. I looked at just some sort of basic division of, okay, here's the cost of the football program, here's the number of athletes, here's what it equals per athlete. It works out to, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars per football player. Versus on academics, if you do the same sort of exercise, it generally works out from somewhere between $10,000 and $20,000 per student. The other way of thinking about it is look at how a school treats its smartest, its brightest, most ambitious students, the ones in public universities who generally end up in the honors colleges. And what you see there is all over the map. I mean, some schools are very generous, and some schools aren't nearly as generous. At Oregon, I looked at the Honors College, and the scholarship that they gave out in 2012, I think, was $5,000 if you got in the Honors College. But of that, they charged you $3,000 because you were in the Honors College under the assumption you got a better education. So it netted out to a scholarship of $2,000. Now, some of those kids are getting other scholarships, but just looking at the Honors College, $2,000. Value of a football scholarship, just the tuition, room, and board, is going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $45,000 to $50,000 at a place like Oregon. And then that doesn't include all this other hand-holding for academics. Yeah.
That was author Gilbert Gall with Steve Fast. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Mark Dennis is a name familiar to many WJBC listeners. He hadn't intended a career in radio, but he tells the story of how it happened and the many memorable moments and stories he covered here with WJBC's Terry James in our Throwback Thursday interview.
Welcome to the studio.
It is really neat to be back. See the things that are the same and the things that have changed. It's such a neat blend because everything I look at is, oh, that's new. Wow, that's the same thing we had.
You told me you were hired by Colleen Reynolds.
For the newsroom part,
yeah.
in 1999, but in 91 I was hired by one of the old triumvirates of the station, Don Munson, Steve mm-hmm. Vogel, and Ken Behrens.
All right. We know all those folks.
They were looking for a part-time weekend announcer so that Jim Brown could have some time off and Willis Kern. And so they I came along at a time where they needed someone, but it was after 6 years in the nuclear Navy. I had just come back from the Gulf War in 1991, and how I got here was kind of neat. I came in as a veteran in the spring of that year, and I stopped by the station, and I wanted to say thank you to the community for all the outpouring of support that we got as service people during the Gulf War. So I stopped in the lobby at that time was on this side of the building, and stopped in and told, you know, the receptionist, I'd like to do that. I'd like to just go on the air and say thank you very quickly and leave. And then Steve Vogel came down. He brought me up to Studio A. And in Studio A was Bones Bach. It was his afternoon show, and Dick Lucky was there doing sports. And the two of them talked to me for about 20 minutes. And I got to say my thank you, but it started something in my mind and maybe in the station's. So,
well, you know, if you walk into the station, we're not going to let you just say thank you. You have to come on and do an interview. So,
and Bones says, what was your degree in journalism? Oh, really?
Well, we happen to be looking for somebody right now. Again, talking with Mark Dennis, formerly here of WJBC, as we celebrate 90 years on the radio. Let's talk about some of the things that happen here. And it looks like 2000 was a major year for you because, you know, elections are big here at WJBC, and we did not know who the President of the United States was for quite some time. How did that go?
That's right. You know, for years in newsrooms, we've been used to calling elections. There's a point where the trends and the preponderance of votes around the country, you can just about say with fairly, you know, some certainty who the winner is in any race. So we were there, you know, we even had discussed how we were going to call the election, what it would take for us to say WJBC calls the election this way. And then there was something going on in Florida. They had a punch card voting system, and there was these things called hanging chads.
Who's Chad and why was he hanging? What are you talking about?
And for those maybe who don't remember that, you know, we always have to remember we're talking generations here.
Mm-hmm.
A hanging Chad was when you punched a punch card, but the little piece of paper that you punched out didn't fall out. And so when the people were manually counting those, these little pieces of paper, these hole punches were still in place, and some votes got miscounted. And they went on with this for weeks.
How did WJBC handle that? Did you guys stay on the air throughout the night thinking that this would be solved in the morning?
We did. We did not try to call the election ourselves. There didn't seem to be any one candidate or the other. It was Al Gore and George W. Bush on his first election. And so we were all in the newsroom. Every reporter and half of the on-air staff were working there until about 2 in the morning. And after that, we said, well, I don't think there's going to be an answer by the crack of dawn. We'll have to come back tomorrow, which was today, and and revisit this. And it turned out it went on for weeks.
Oh, absolutely.
Before Al Gore conceded.
Well, another memory, and this is a funny one. You had a situation with an emu. Now, let me say that. I have not said that animal name in a while. You say it.
Emu.
Okay.
And believe me, I had to figure that out, too, that day. Well, it was just like what you folks are doing. It was a weekend or a holiday, and I was standing watch in the newsroom here at WJBC. And so, between the top of the hour news and the bottom of the hour news is when I would make phone calls and every once in a while, you know, turn my ear toward the police scanner. And over the scanner, I was hearing this. There's an emu on I-55. And this is the state patrol. And I thought, I certainly didn't hear that right. It turns out it was within visual distance of the station here. I could look down the street and see the lights turning.
Well, and our location is right where Veterans ends and 55 begins.
Exactly. So I thought, well, there's nothing else going on today. I'm going to go grab a tape recorder, a microphone, and a car, and went jetting down 1 mile down I-55 to where all the excitement was. And sure enough, a 200-pound Australian bird, kind of like an ostrich but without the white feathers, it's called an emu, and it was wandering around on the shoulder of the interstate. Now, at first it was funny, and then it wasn't, because I talked to the patrolman. He says, you know, look at this thing. Hitting this with a car at highway speed would be worse than hitting a deer, because that whole bird would come through your windshield at 60 miles an hour.
Oh, I imagine, yeah.
So it was deadly serious to get this giant bird off of the road. So I came back and, you know, wrote some stories. And then Monday morning, you know, the newsroom kind of blew up about Dennis's emu story. I was like, what?
So I imagine this wasn't a friendly bird that wanted to just be picked up and held and take. Well, you can't really pick it up that easily.
No, they are kind of hostile.
Yeah.
And the reason they were here was that farmers raise ostriches and emus for meat. And there was some experimentation going on with our local farmers. In fact, you could see these birds at the McLean County Fair. So that's how we – but, you know, of all the stories I covered, that's the one that always came back to.
That was former WJBC newsman Mark Dennis in our Throwback Thursday interview with Terry James. Another man familiar to these airwaves is Denver Johnson. He coached the Illinois State football teams for 9 seasons before current coach Brock Spack took over. Now the head man at Missouri Southern, a Division II school in Joplin, Denver Johnson talked to WJBC's Scott Laughlin and Colleen Reynolds about his time in Bloomington Normal.
You came in 2000, and I'll be honest with you, and you know, people were going, who's this guy? This big guy, Southern accent, red cowboy boots. Talk about coming to Normal, Illinois.
Well, it was really a great period of our lives. My wife, Danita, and our daughters, Taylor and Kelsey, we immensely enjoyed our time in Bloomington Normal and at Illinois State University. We had some good runs, had some good teams, and, you know, some great players, and nothing but fond memories there. Have great friends there to this day. So it was really a great time for us, and we miss it dearly.
And you came from Murray State?
Correct, yes. So, Murray State, which is in western Kentucky.
And talk about the difference, the size of schools and the media coverage, because, you know, of course, WJBC, the voice of the Redbirds. Talk about that transition. Was it much of a difference?
Well, it was some. It was a bigger school. Murray was a about 7,500 students. They may be 8,000 students or so when I was there. So Illinois State was a much larger school. You know, probably my greatest affiliation was with you guys at WJBC. We had what I thought was a great coaches show. You know, I would come on sometimes in the summer and fill in for someone on vacation. We had a lot of fun doing those type of things. So that was really pretty cool. The biggest change for us personally was just the winters in Central Illinois were a lot tougher than what we were used to. So it took us 2 or 3 years to get acclimated to that. But, you know, once we did and our wardrobe changed a little bit, we were just fine.
You also worked under Shan Zanger. Talk about the relationship there. I know, I mean, when he came to town, he really changed things in terms of, you know, he started that Spread the Red campaign and I think really converted this community into, you know, sort of a Redbird zone.
Well, I agree with you, Colleen. I think he was a very impactful athletic director. You know, during my time there, it was really a pretty tumultuous time at Illinois State. We went through changes in presidents. We went through changes in athletic directors. We went through a couple of changes in basketball coaches, women basketball coaches, volleyball coaches. There was a lot of turnover, a lot of change, a lot of coming and going during that time. And I really felt like when Shane came in, there was a professionalism that came with that, a stability that came with that, and maybe a vision that came with him that was really, I think, has probably set the stage for all the success that they're having there now. Now, I think tremendous kudos have to go to Larry Lyons. I tell you what, he has taken that program and that department and ran with it. Of course, he was a very confident professional guy during my time there in his role, and I always thought that Larry would be a great athletic director and has proved to be. So, you know, between Cheyenne getting it started and Larry carrying it on, well, there's great things going on there on campus at ISU.
So you leave Illinois State in 2008. Do you want to tell the boot story or should I?
You can.
I was on vacation. As a matter of fact, oddly enough, I was on vacation out in Colorado, and R.C. McBride says, hey, did you hang some boots from our flagpole? Red boots. And we knew whose boots they were, and I said, no. I'm in Colorado. I didn't do it. I said, it had to be Denver. And I come back in, and I think I either texted you or called you, and you said, yeah, you didn't need the red boots anymore because you were headed out to Colorado to coach as an assistant.
Correct.
So the boots were hanging on the flagpole out here, and so I kept those boots. And when you got the job at Tulsa, which I know is a job you love to go back home because, number one, you don't sound funny down there. And number two, that's your alma mater. So I went to Red Wing Shoes, Adrian Shoes and Repair, another free plug for those guys today. And I said, can you take these red boots and make them Tulsa blue? And they said, absolutely. And they did it, and I shipped them to you. Where are those boots today?
They're in my closet. I wore them several times at Tulsa, and I still have them today. And I don't know if they could stand another color change.
Yeah, I know.
I still have them.
What are you, green and gold now? What are the colors?
We're green and gold, yeah. I just, maybe in a little act of defiance there, felt like I had to run my boots up the flagpole. Maybe just my final so long
yeah.
Blooming to normal. But glad that you retrieved them and rehabilitated them.
Yeah.
You know, Denver, another part of your tenure here, you really made a mark on the community, I think, in terms of public service, and you gave some awesome motivational speeches and also really helped out St. Jude a lot. That was, I think, people will remember you for that almost as much as what a great coach you were.
Well, I hope so. We've always tried to, you know, give back in any way that we can. And obviously St. Jude was and remains a very dear cause to us because of our daughter Kelsey's being a patient there when she was four. My older daughter, Taylor, actually works for St. Jude now. She works for ALSAC and lives in Oklahoma City and in that office and just doing a great job there. She's raising a lot of money and doing great things there. But that was huge for us. But, you know, other things in the community we tried to get involved in. And, you know, I like to speak. I don't know that I'm any good at it, but I sure like to do it. So I was always appreciative of any opportunity that I had to go speak, particularly to young people, to a sports banquet, to a FCA banquet. I think I actually did a baccalaureate service there at Norman Community High School that I very much enjoyed doing. You know, any of those things that I could do, I very much enjoyed the opportunity to do and got pretty good feedback on most of that stuff.
All right, so let's catch up on where you've been since you left Illinois State University. Give us the roadmap.
Well, I left Illinois State, went to Colorado, was out there for 2 years, and then I left there, went back to Tulsa, to the University of Tulsa, which, as you mentioned before, is my alma mater. And really, Tulsa is what I consider my hometown. My mother and father both passed away, and although I grew up in southern Oklahoma, you know, went to school there in Tulsa, and that's where most of my buddies and such live now, so that's what I consider my hometown. Was hoping that I'd be there for 12 or 15 years and then maybe get out of coaching. I believe I'd like to get into administration, either an athletic director role, assistant athletic director role, maybe a fundraising role. I think I would enjoy that, you know, post-coaching. But Coach Blankenship, the head coach, got into a tussle with the administration and got himself fired, and of course when the head coach gets fired, the assistant coaches all go too. So found myself looking for a job and had several opportunities, but this one came along here. It's not too far from Tulsa, only an hour and a half, and was another head coaching opportunity. And the opportunity, as we talked earlier, to essentially start a program from scratch, which is something that I was really attracted to. Dr. Alan Marble is our president. He's new as well. Colleen mentioned Shane Zenger. I think Dr. Marble is kind of the equivalent to that in the presidential role. So it just seemed to me to be a good time maybe to be in Joplin, Missouri, and at Missouri Southern. We've really enjoyed it so far.
That was former ISU football coach Denver Johnson with Scott and Colleen. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. Voters in Illinois' 18th Congressional District chose Republican Darren LaHood by a wide margin in a special election. WJBC's Joe Ragusa says about 9% of registered voters in McLean County went to the polls.
LaHood says he wasn't surprised by the low turnout.
I think it's a reflection of having a special election. This was the only thing on the ballot. It was in the middle of the summer. We had the first primary in July and the second one on a Thursday in September. And it's hard to get people motivated to get out and vote.
LaHood received about 69% of the vote. His opponent, Democrat Rob Mellon, says there were some good and bad things to take away from his campaign.
I thought I did as best I could. And obviously I look back at it now and there's things I would have done differently. There's different groups that I wish I would have had an opportunity to go speak to. There's different communities I would have spent a lot more time in if I had an opportunity.
LaHood will replace Aaron Schock, who resigned in March after numerous reports and a federal investigation into his use of campaign and taxpayer dollars. Joe Ragusa, WJBC and WJBC.com.
A 1% sales tax increase, a step closer to reality in Normal after the town council voted to approve of the measure. WJBC's Adam Stasinski has that story.
If the increase is also approved in Bloomington, 25% of the revenue generated would go towards mental health care. Councilwoman Cheryl Gaines says there are other needs this tax would fund.
All of these things that we've heard from are going to not just improve, helped improve people's lives, but it's going to help improve everyone who owns a home, their value they have within their home.
Mental health is the only area which is being earmarked to receive funding, but Connect Transit, business development, and a new athletic facility could all see money. Bloomington could vote on the measure next week. Adam Stasinski, WJBC and WJBC.com.
District 87 has approved tax abatements for three local properties. WJBC's Andy Dane reports the district is hoping to cash in on future tax revenue while giving the community a boost.
The future location of six loft apartments on North Main Street, Greentop Grocery on East Washington Street, and apartments on West Washington Street that are nearly finished were the properties that had their tax abatements approved by the school board Wednesday night. Superintendent Barry Riley says the approval is a smart long-term investment for the district and the community.
We didn't lose money from the point where we're at. In other words, we have a baseline to start from. The current tax dollars that we receive, that is maintained for each of those years. And as the property gets developed and the value grows, of course, the tax revenue will grow along with that. We'll see that benefit a few years down the road.
Andy Dane, WJBC and WJBC.com.
Illinois State University has been ranked the 79th best public university in the nation by U.S. News & World Report. The ranking was partially due to ISU's 17-to-1 student-to-teacher ratio. Chief of Staff Jay Grove says the schools have been able to keep a good student-to-teacher ratio despite welcoming record-breaking freshman classes the past 2 years.
One of Illinois State's core values is individualized attention, and students that you might talk to or alumni even will tell you about the close student and faculty and staff interaction we have at the university. That's one reason that ISU is so popular for students, and we're glad that that's keeping going.
Illinois Wesleyan was rated 72nd in the latest U.S. News & World Report ranking among liberal arts colleges. Meanwhile, Illinois State University is rescheduling the president's annual State of the University address. The event, originally scheduled for Tuesday, is being moved back due to the death of President Larry Deese's brother. A new date has not yet been selected. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, Illinois Wesleyan University will announce its 19th president following the retirement of Dick Wilson, who has held the post for 11 years. Also Monday, Danielle Fisher of Bloomington is scheduled to stand trial on murder charges for the death of her 3-year-old son, Robbie Kramer, in 2013. Bloomington's City Council is expected to discuss a sales tax increase on Monday night. On Wednesday, Illinois State University's Democracy Project will host a watch party and social media event for the second Republican presidential debate. And Thursday, McLean County Community Compact will host a meeting at Heartland Community College to help businesses and organizations looking to hire young talent. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stott.